Chapter 9. This was the kind of sailing that Stephen liked. With a gentle breeze a little north of east, the Surprise, with her tender under her lee, made a steady 4.5 knots under all plain sail or a trifle less, with a pitch and roll that he scarcely noticed. At first he'd wondered at the absence of kites, of royals, stunsails and all their interesting variety. And the frigate's placid advance had vexed him to the soul, until reflection told him that Jack Aubrey understood his profession as well as any man afloat, that he was perfectly well acquainted with the relative positions of Arcilla and Gibraltar, and that his plans must take the moon into consideration. No corsair commanding a galley ballasted with gold was going to attempt the passage of the strait when she was full, or anything like it. Yet, still, it grieved his unreasoning part, no inconsiderable part of the man, when t'gallants were taken in at the setting of the watch. This evening he'd come on deck for a breath of fresh air, leaving the sick bay, rather fuller than usual, with the diseases often produced by so much shore leave and by some cases of military fever, in Jacob's care. And he sat on a coil of rope right forward. He could hear the children hooting and screeching in the maintop, for the midshipmen and the hands indulged them extremely. They were picking up an extraordinary amount of English, and so far they'd done themselves no serious injury. Yet as he sat there, pondering, his mind was very much less concerned with them than with the new commander-in-chief at Gibraltar. Admiral Lord Barmouth, his family name was Richardson, had been a famous frigate captain with several brilliant actions to his credit. Jack Aubrey was now a famous frigate captain, and one or two of his actions were perhaps even more brilliant. Early in his career, Jack had served under Captain Richardson as a master's mate in the Sibylle. They had disagreed from time to time, never seriously, but enough for Captain Richardson not to ask Jack to follow him when he moved to his next command, a heavy frigate in which, with a consort of almost equal force, he destroyed a French ship of the line on the coast of Brittany. Jack was sorry not to have been present at the battle, but that didn't prevent him from taking young Arklow Richardson aboard a command of his own and even rating him, in his turn, master's mate, a senior midshipman. Yet, in young Arklow, all the sides of his father, now Lord Barmouth, that Jack had disliked, were reproduced on a larger and more offensive scale. In the severe naval discipline of the time, even a master's mate could be rude, cruel and tyrannical, and Arklow made full use of his opportunities. To some extent, a captain is obliged to support his officer, and reluctantly Jack reproved, stopped grog, or imposed some other small punishment. But presently it became obvious that Arklow had no intention of attending to his captain's often strongly worded advice. More than that, there was not a single able seaman aboard who did not see that Arklow differed from his father in being no sailor. When this was established beyond a doubt, Jack got rid of him. But he did so in such a tactful manner that the youth, the very well-connected youth, was very soon a lieutenant. Then he was given command of a vessel of his own, where he could flog as much as he chose. Not unnaturally, his people mutinied. And the case against the young man was so flagrantly obvious that he was never employed again. Barmouth didn't openly hold this against Jack Aubrey. They were members of the same club in London, and they exchanged civil words when they met. But the powers of a commander-in-chief were very wide indeed. And if Surprise reached Gibraltar in anything but perfect condition, Barmouth might very well order another wholly undamaged frigate to undertake the interception of the galley. Indeed, Surprise had not been wholly surveyed and passed at Mahon. How this had come about, Stephen couldn't tell for certain, but he supposed that Admiral Fanshawe, who was aware of the urgency and who was very fond of Jack, had taken his word for the frigate's perfect health. This supposition was much reinforced by the quite unusual activity of the carpenter, his mates and crew, who were busy all day and even after lights out in the filling room, right forward and far down, and in the forepeak, hammering, sawing, fitting, and driving great wedges. Stephen had pointed out that this was not all that could be wished for so near the sick berth. But observing Jack's embarrassment, his uneasy and probably false assertion that it was nothing and anyway it would soon be over, he'd not pressed the subject. The more so since Jacob happened to be with them at the time, tuning a fiddle he'd bought in Mahon so that they might attempt Haydn in D major. The carpenter, too, was oddly reticent, as though there were something improper or even illegal about the work in the forepeak in its neighbourhood, a near furtiveness that took refuge in technicalities. "We'm just setting the horse pieces in bollard," Timbers to rights. And Stephen was wondering how far down in the carpenter's chain of command this attitude reached, when a small pair of calico drawers were flung down at his feet, and Poll cried, "No, sir, no, for shame. There's that heathen Mona running about mother naked but for her Algiers shirt, and she's thrown down her drawers. I've tried to teach her shame, and so has Mrs. Tyler, but it's no good. She just says, 'No English, ha ha,' lays aloft and throws her drawers to the wind." "I'm very sorry for your trouble, Poll, my dear," said Stephen, "but I'll tell you what I shall do. Barrett Bondon is a good creature, and a capital hand with needle and thread. I shall beg him to make a pair, two pair, of a number 8 sailcloth trousers, tight at the top, broad down below, and the seams piped with green. Once she has them on, she'll never throw them off, I warrant you. The same for her brother Kevin, too." Poll shook her head. "When I think of all that good calico, the cutting, the measuring, and the fine stitching, look at those flounces. I could find it in my heart to have her whipped and put in the black hole with biscuit and water." The trousers were indeed successful. In both cases, they were a cause of sinful pride, and they never came off, but hid the children's shameful parts day and night, except when they went to the head. Furthermore, they promoted such a degree of agility and daring that, on an idle day, with light airs coming from all points of the compass, a make-and-mend day, too, with most of the hands busy with thimbles and shears on the forecastle or in the waist of the ship, Kevin, on his way to the mainmast head, discerned his sail in the west, bringing up a little breeze of its own. Partly out of mother wit, and partly because he couldn't remember the English for west, he climbed the remaining few feet and told Gagan, the lookout, who had been watching a couple of tunny boats far astern, but who now hailed the deck. "On deck there, on deck! A sail 3 points on the starboard bow!" Then, sometime later, "Frigate, sir, I believe." Pause. "Yes. Hammer Dryad, and she's making sail." "What joy!" said Jack to Stephen. "That'll be Heneage Dundas out of Gibraltar. I've not congratulated him yet on his new ship. We'll ask him to supper. A pair of fowls, and there's still plenty of sucking pig. Killick! Killick there! Pass the word for Killick." And when his steward arrived, with his invariable look of ill usage and a denial of anything, anything at all that might be alleged against him, "Killick, freshen some champagne, will you?" "Which we ain't got none, Your Honour," said Killick, barely containing his triumph. "Not since the Admiral dined aboard. Oh, dear me, no. Some white burgundy, then. And let it down in a net on a 20-fathom line." There was no white burgundy either, but Killick was capable of relishing a private victory too, and he only replied, "A 20-fathom line it is, sir." "Now, Mr. Hallam," said Jack to his signal midshipman, "once the usual signals are passed, pray invite Captain Dundas and Mr. Reed to supper. Doctor, should you like to come up into the foretop to watch Hammer Dryad make sail?" It was not really a very dangerous ascent, nor lofty, and Stephen had been known to go even higher entirely by himself. But he had so often been found clinging by his fingernails to improbable parts of the rigging that Jack and Bondon exchanged a private look of thankful relief when they'd successfully pushed and pulled him up into the top through the lubber's hole. Though the foretop was of no great height, it gave them a splendid view of the western Mediterranean. They were a little late for some of the phases of Hamadryad's increase of sail, but still there were many delights to come. Stunsails aloft and alow on either side of fore and mainmast, of course, and even royal stunsails, which was coming in pretty high, as Jack observed. Then a skysail above the main royal. "And look, look, Stephen," cried Jack, "the audacious reptiles flashed out a skyscraper, you see. The fore and aft affair above everything. Take my glass and you'll make out its sheet. Did you ever see the like, Bondon?"
"Never, sir. But once when I was aboard Melpomene in the Doldrums, we spread a sail above the royal. Though it being square, we called it a moonsail."
This prodigious spread brought Hamadryad within pistol shot of the little surprise before dusk. She clapped her helm a lee, swung round in an elegant curve, spilt the wind from her sails, furled her wings, and sent her captain across the narrow lane in his barge as neat and trim as the Channel Fleet. "My dear hen, how do you do?" cried Jack, receiving him on the quarter-deck with a hearty shake of his hand. "You know Dr. Maturin and all my officers, I believe?" Captain Dundas made his round of civilities. "Come below," said Jack, "and let's have a wet. You must be mortal parched after such a frantic spread of cloth. What did you make?"
"Only a span above 8 knots, even with all our washing hung out to dry," said Dundas, laughing. "But it did please our topmen. Certainly amazed all ours. Amazed and impressed. Sherry or a draught of right Plymouth gin?"
"Oh, gin, if you please. Two of our victuallers were stove on the Burlings in that shocking southerly blow, and we've not had a drop since then. They happened to be carrying it all. Didn't the wind reach as far as you?"
"Yes, and as far as Alexandria, I believe. A truly wicked blast. But tell me, hen,"
pouring him a stiff tot and speaking with an affectation of casual unconcern that deceived neither of his friends, "what is Lord Barmouth in the way of frigates?"
"None at all," said Dundas. "Some battered 74s, a 64-gun ship, some indifferent sloops, and, of course, the flag. But Hamadryad was the last of the frigates. The rest have been sent to Malta and eastwards, though indeed he is to be reinforced in 2 or 3 weeks, or perhaps earlier. They, too, were much delayed by the weather, carrying the CNC's new wife, and had to put back into Lisbon."
Jack drank his own sherry with satisfaction, and they sat down to a remarkably copious supper. Picking up his fork, he said, "Did you say that Lord Barmouth was remarried? I heard nothing about it."
"He was, though, to Admiral Horton's remarkably handsome young widow. It's her absence that makes him crosser than usual."
Jack nodded vaguely, and in the pause between the pair of fowls and the sucking pig, he asked, "Did you wait on Lord Keith?"
"Yes, I did," said Dundas. "I had a message for him from my father, but I should have gone in any case. I have a great respect for the Admiral."
"So have I. How was Lady Keith?"
"As lovely and kind and learned as ever. She was good enough to ask me to dinner, and she and the chaplain of one of the 74s prattled away about some peculiarities of the Hebrew used in the Jewish community on the rock."
"Do they indeed use a colloquial Hebrew?" asked Stephen. "I'd always supposed that they kept to their archaic Spanish."
"From what I gathered, they spoke Hebrew when Jews from remote countries appeared. Countries where Arabic or Persian took the place of Spanish. Rather, as those more learned than I am use Latin when they're in Poland, or, God preserve us, Lithuania."
"As I remember," said Jack, "they meant to take a house somewhere near the governor's cottage."
"Just so. Balinden.
It's a little higher up, but somewhat closer to the town. A charming place, with a prodigious view of the straits and a fine garden kept by a scorpion. Perhaps rather large for them, and I'm afraid the apes are a nuisance at times, but they both seem very happy there."
"Bless them," said Jack, raising his glass. "They were both most uncommon kind to me."
Pudding came on almost as soon as they'd drunk the Keith's health, a fine, honest, naval pudding of the kind that Jack and Dundas loved, and to which Stephen, unlike Jacob, had become inured.
"Thank you very much," said Dundas, refusing a second piece. "And I'm afraid I must..."
Before he could utter the words, "tear myself away,"
The surprises bell struck 8 times. The cabin door opened, and the midshipman in charge of Captain Dundas' barge said, "Sir, you told me to..."
"Very true, Simmons," said Dundas. "Jack, thank you many, many times for a splendid supper. But if I don't speed on my way, I shall be flogged round the fleet. Gentlemen," bowing to Stephen and Jacob, "your servant." All was over. The table cleared all but for the brandy. Jacob had said good night, and a curious silence filled the cabin. "Seeing Dundas hurry off in such a dutiful, truly naval fashion," said Stephen, "puts me in mind of an indiscreet question that I have often been tempted to ask you, and since, after all, I too am essentially concerned in our voyage, I shall venture upon it now. If Heneage Dundas is in danger of being flogged round the fleet for dillying and dallying on his way, may you not run the same risk when at last your snail's pace brings you to Gibraltar and the commander-in-chief, who is not your very closest friend?" "Stephen," said Jack, "I dare say you've noticed that the moon changes both her shape and her hours of rising and setting from time to time." "Indeed I have. A most inconstant orb. Sometimes a mere sickle facing left, sometimes right, and sometimes, as I've no doubt you've observed yourself, no moon at all. The dark of the moon. I remember you once landed me on the French coast at just such a time. Yet I'm no great lunarian. A priest in the County Clare explained her motions to me, but I'm afraid I didn't fully retain his words. He did persuade you that it was a regular process, that the changes could be foretold. I'm sure he did, at least to his own satisfaction. It is the case, I do assure you, Stephen. And the very first appearance of the new moon at certain seasons is of the utmost consequence to Jews and Muslims. Now, you are aware that the commander of the Arzila galley must be either the one or the other, almost certainly a Muslim, and, in any case, a sailor. Furthermore, he is presumably a sailor in his right mind. So, wind and weather permitting, he must necessarily pass through the strait at the dark of the moon, or as near as ever he can get to it. A night that he can foretell as well as we can. So, seeing that both he and I think alike, I hope to give him the meeting somewhere south of Tarifa." "To be sure, that puts a different complexion on the matter. Furthermore, I have no wish to lose any spars by cracking on, nor to lie there day after day under the eye of a commander-in-chief who dislikes me. He's a very distinguished sailor, I fully admit, and his reputation as a fighting captain was very high indeed. Yet, as a flag officer, he has been less fortunate. It's very odd, but there's something about the Admiralty boardroom table that has a sad effect on some of those who sit there. Sensible men who can club haul their ship off a roaring lee shore, or take a huge Spanish beauty like the Santissima Trinidad and remain perfectly civil and unassuming until this point, this boardroom table. It's not invariable, but I have served under some who, on becoming a sea lord, above all, first sea lord, who suddenly swell up into creatures of enormous importance, you have to be approached on hands and knees and addressed in the third person. Now, Lord Barmouth will have a monument in the Abbey with a great many fine actions engraved upon it, but he's perfectly capable of doing a dirty thing. And I should rather make my obeisance a very short time before the dark of the moon and then go about my business, looking as much like a distressed merchantman as possible." It was a good plan. It kept the ship from the wear and tear of a hurried passage, so that, apart from other considerations, she should be entirely ready for the eagerly expected meeting. But it was based on the false assumption that the commander-in-chief should be sitting in Gibraltar. He was, in fact, exercising the vessels under his command. The ships of the line to port, the sloops and minor craft to starboard in line abreast,
and well behind them sailed a numerous convoy of merchantmen. This surprising armada was reported bit by bit from the masthead as the morning cleared, starting with the foremost division of sloops, and Jack had time to spread more canvas. Much more canvas to the nor'east breeze before the hail came down. On deck there, on deck. Flag, 2 points on the starboard bow. Fortunately, the surprise was in a high state of cleanliness. Decks already dry from the swabbing, guns as neat as a paper of pins, all hands reasonably well turned out and necessarily stone-cold sober. But this didn't prevent Harding, Woodbine and the Royal Marine officer from fussing about the ship, or Killick from overhauling the Rear Admiral's uniform that Jack wore on formal occasions as Commodore. The day cleared. The signal midshipman and his yeoman watched the almost continual stream of hoists running up aloft as Lord Barmouth put his fleet through a variety of manoeuvres and expressed a variety of comments, mostly unfavourable. At last, surprises number appeared, together with Commodore, repair, aboard, flag. Bondon and his crew already had the barge clear for lowering down, and the moment he saw Jack emerge from his cabin in the glory of number one scraper, presentation sword and a large quantity of gold lace, he gave the word, and the boat glided down, instantly followed by bargemen and a master's mate at the tiller. As soon as we're a cable's length away, said Jack to Harding, start the salute, and I'm sure you'll never forget a couple of spares in case of a misfire. With this he ran down into the barge, and as usual Bondon shoved off, saying to his crew, row dry there, row dry. And when they'd pulled just a cable's length, the surprise began her salute to the commander-in-chief. 17 guns. For this was the first time she'd met him in office. After the 17th, implacable replied, but hesitated slightly after the 13th, as though doubtful of Jack's right to more, though his broad pennant was clearly to be seen. Hesitated until some angry voice roared from the quarter-deck when the remaining two were fired almost together. The captain of Implacable, Henry James, an old shipmate, received Jack kindly as he came aboard. The Royal Marines presented arms, and the flag lieutenant said, "May I take you to the Commander-in-Chief, sir?" "I'm happy to see you, Mr. Aubrey," said Lord Barmouth, half rising from behind his desk and giving him a cold hand. "So am I, upon my word," said Sir James Freer, the captain of the fleet, whose grasp was much more cordial. "But I don't quite understand what you're doing in these waters. Pray sit down while you tell me." "My lord, the previous commander-in-chief gave me a squadron with orders to proceed to the Ionian and Adriatic and, having seen the trade on its way, to put an end to Bonapartist shipbuilding in those parts, to persuade some French ships to come over to the Allies, and to take, sink, burn, and destroy those who would not. An emissary from Sir Joseph Blaine also spoke of the ministry's concern at reports of a Muslim confederacy's intention of preventing the junction of the Russian and Austrian forces marching westward to join the British and Prussian armies, or at least to delay it long enough for Napoleon's superior numbers to crush each of the Allied states separately. This move on the part of the Muslim group, however, required the enlistment of a large number of mercenaries, and they had to be paid. The money was to come from a Muslim state on the confines of Morocco, and it was expected to travel by way of Algiers. Our intelligence people eventually put an end to that, and it is now to come by sea, through the Straits, as I've told Lord Keith in repeated dispatches, not knowing that it had been superseded. Perhaps I should add that Sir Joseph also supplied my political adviser with a local expert, a gentleman perfectly fluent in Turkish and Arabic, who was of the greatest value. With his help, we detached one French frigate, destroyed two others, and burned a score of yards together with the ships they were building. "Yes," said the Admiral, "I've heard something of it, and I congratulate you on your success, I'm sure." "How we banged them about," murmured Sir James. "Have you prepared a report?" "Not yet, my lord. Then you can come back to Gibraltar with us and let me have it there as soon as possible. You spoke of your political adviser and his colleague?
Yes, my lord.
I should be obliged if you would send them both across to confer with my politico. And Aubrey, although Lord Keith gave you quite a handsome squadron, it's melted away for convoy duty and the like. What's that schooner you have in company?
She belongs to my surgeon, sir, and she acts as our tender.
Well, she's a handsome little craft, but she don't amount to a squadron. So perhaps it would be more proper if you were to strike your broad pennant and revert to a private ship. Jack had intended to ask the Commander-in-Chief whether there was any news of the French or Allied armies, but these last words were so clearly meant to be disobliging that he merely took his leave. On deck, however, he found Implacable's captain, who said that although there were rumours of the wildest sort, such as a rising in Ireland and a French invasion of Kent, he'd heard nothing authentic except for the soldiers' exasperation, frequently expressed, at the Russians' slowness. Jack nodded with satisfaction and then said, "Lord Barmouth has ordered me to send my surgeon and a politico across. They're amazingly gifted linguists and very learned men, but neither has much notion of coming up the side of a ship. And was you to rig a bosun's chair, I should take it kindly." Back in the Surprise, he took off his finery, struck his broad pennant, told Harding to follow the flag into Gibraltar, and sent for the logbooks. He and Adams were still establishing the basis of his report, obviously with great gaps that only Stephen and Jacob could fill, when they heard the boat's return, the anxious cries, and the children's piping, "Welcome aboard, dear doctors, welcome, oh, welcome aboard!" Coming below, Stephen looked attentively at his friend, deep in papers, and said, "You are low in your spirits, brother."
"Indeed I am. For your own ear alone, I'm very much afraid that we're going to be balked of our galley. Pipped on the post. Done brown. In my simplicity, I told the Commander-in-Chief that she was coming up by the Straits and that I meant to intercept her. I let it be understood that I was still acting on the orders given me by Lord Keith. But I fear I may be set aside and the chance given to some more favoured man."
"Be easy in your mind, my dear," said Stephen, in a tone that carried great conviction. "Jacob and I have just been talking with the Commander-in-Chief and his politico, then with the politico alone. Matthew Arden, a very intelligent man, very highly influential in Whitehall. The Ministry regard this as an exceptionally important theatre of war, and they have sent one of their best brains, a man who has refused high office, very high office indeed. He is also a close friend of Lord Keith's, who would be mortally offended at having his evident wishes set aside. Arden and I have known one another these many years. We have never disagreed on any important point, and this time again we got along together exceedingly well. Furthermore, I am happy to say that for all his domineering manner, Lord Barmouth is in awe of Matthew Arden. You're drawing up an account of our little campaign, I see. Heavy going, heavy going. I must give you some remarks on Algerine politics and my sojourn in Africa. But I do wish you could have heard how Arden exulted at your doing in the Adriatic and how he obliged the Commander-in-Chief to acknowledge that the elimination of that particular danger was a most important feat. No, no, Jack. Courageous though Lord Barmouth quite certainly is, I do not believe for a moment that he would dare to use you ill in these circumstances."
"How very kind you are to tell me all this, Stephen," said Jack. "From anyone else, I should scarcely have regarded it. But from you..." He threw aside the pen he'd been chewing, walked across the cabin, took up his fiddle and played a wild series of very rapid ascending trills that vanished quite out of hearing. Then he sat at his desk, and with another pen he quickly drew up several lists, sent for the gunner and asked him for a state of the ship's powder and shot. "I can tell you quite exactly after 5 minutes' look round the magazine, sir," said the gunner. "Very well.
Then you fill in the figures to top us up when I've left room and take them along. Here's a guinea to sweeten the usual palm for reasonable dispatch. Then there is this also for the ordnance wharf. Blue lights and red, murmured the gunner, slowly going through the list. We do have a few, but it's as well to be sure they're fresh. Then extra high Congreves. I don't think I know about them, sir. They're white starbursts, and on occasion they can be very useful. Half a guinea for all the fireworks together would be about right, I believe. Oh, very handsome, sir. And I make no doubt I shall bring them back myself. When this interview and a few others that showed the trend of Captain Aubrey's mind were over, Stephen said, "And I shall be getting some medical stores. We're sadly short of portable soup, and since that unfortunate lingering in Mahon blue ointment. Tell me, Jack, am I right in supposing that we shall have 4 or even 5 days longer here than you'd wished?" "No, you're quite right." "Then shall you wait on Lady Keith?" "Of course I shall. And on the Admiral, too." "Please, may I come with you?" "By all means. Queenie speaks of you so pleasantly." On the day of the visit, Stephen went ashore early, bought a new wig at Barlow's, and searched through the entire market until he found a pot of lilies of the valley in just opening bud. Returning, he gave Mona and Kevin a square of chocolate calculated for solid jaws and iron stomachs. Yet, though they thanked him prettily, they neither ate nor moved, but stood gazing up in something between wonder and alarm. At last Mona said, "You've changed your hair." "Never mind, my dear," he replied, "it's only a wig." He took it off to show, and both instantly burst into tears. "Dear Lady Keith," he said as they sat in the parlour overlooking her fine garden and the street with misty Africa on the far side, "do you remember the first time you ever saw a man without his wig?" "No. Papa always took it off when he was teaching me to swim at Brighton, and I was so much concerned with splattering that I didn't remark the change, or scarcely. A rapid molt indeed, but a perfectly natural one. I ask because my two children, the children that I bought in the slave market at Algiers, a boy and a girl, twins, wept most bitterly when I took mine off this morning and couldn't be comforted. Poor little souls. There are those damned apes again. Jack, pray bang on the window, will you? How old are they?" "Just losing their milk teeth. An Algerine corsair took them off the Munster coast, and I mean to send them back to their parents, peasants in a village I know. I hope to find King's ship bound for the Cove of Cork. There should be no difficulty. I shall ask the Admiral. But what do you mean to do with them in the meanwhile? If you're ordered to sea, for example, ordered to the West Indies?" "I'd hope to find a suitable, kindly family to keep them until a suitable, kindly man of war should carry them home, with a letter to a priest I know in Cork and a purse to take them to Ballydunegan in an ass cart. Do they speak English?" "Very little, and much of that little rather coarse. But it's wonderful how the infant mind absorbs a language through the ears. Well, if you like to entrust them to me, I shall tell our Scorpion, our chief gardener, to put them up. He has a good wife, quite a large cottage, and only grown-up children. He speaks English, rock English, and he's a good, decent man. In any case, I shall look after them." "How deeply kind of you, Lady Keith. May I bring them up later today?" "Please do. I shall look forward to seeing them. But tell me now, Dr. Maturin, what did you see on the Barbary coast in the way of birds?" "Some way inland there was a vast saline lake crowded with flamingos and a large variety of waders. Vultures, all the usual kinds, the brown-necked raven. Among the mere quadrupeds there were hyenas, of course, and an elegant leopard. But what would really have pleased you was an anomalous nuthatch." "Dear me, Maturin," cried Lady Keith, who was particularly attached to nuthatches. "Anomalous in what respect?" "Well, You instantly see that he is a nuthatch, though an absurdly small one. But then you realise that he has almost no black on his crown, that his whole mantle is more nearly blue than is quite proper, that his tail is even shorter than that of other species, and that his voice is more like that of a wryneck than... The description was cut short by the Admiral, bursting in with the cry, "Oh, those hell-damned apes, they're at it again!" But his indignant voice changed when he saw the visitors. "Why, Aubrey, how very welcome you are. You too, Doctor. Lord, how you stirred them up in the Adriatic. Your earlier dispatches came to me, of course, and they gave a great deal of pleasure in Whitehall. And I do hope you will both give us the pleasure of your company at dinner on Saturday." "Should be very happy, my lord, but I have not yet quite finished carrying out your orders. I hope to have done so a little after the new moon, and then we are entirely at your disposal." The sound of a carriage, of another carriage, the voices of two different sets of callers. Jack and Stephen took their leave, and by good luck they were able to skirt round the newcomers, all gathered in a knot on the gravel drive, exclaiming at the extraordinary coincidence of the arrival at the very same moment. They walked back to the town, and as they went along the quays, Stephen noticed the daily Tangier hoy, it might almost have been called the ferry, rapidly filling with Moors, Gibraltar Jews, and some odd few Spanish merchants. Jacob was among them, in a caftan and a skullcap, wholly inconspicuous. Stephen made no remark at the time, but he wasn't surprised at finding a suitably obscure note from his colleague saying that he was crossing to see some people who might have some quite valuable jewels to sell. But later, as he and Jack were supping together, he said, "I believe Jacob is not officially on the ship's books. No, I think he's carried as a supernumerary without victuals, wages or tobacco." "Who feeds him, then?" "Well, I suppose you do. At any rate, everything he eats or drinks or smokes will be stopped out of your pay to the last halfpenny and with the utmost rigour. I find that I have been giving my life's blood to a parcel of hard-hearted, mercenary, rapacious sharks," said Stephen, with a rather forced smile. "Exactly so. And the children you bought in Algiers have each a docket on which every dish of pap is charged against you, together with the earthenware pot they broke. This is the Navy, after all. So I do not suppose he would be flogged or put in irons for absenting himself without formal leave. No. In such cases we have a punishment known as keel hauling. But don't let it distress you. The victims often survive. Well, fairly often. But I'm so sorry, this really is not the time to be facetious. I'm afraid you must be missing your children cruelly. They were engaging little creatures. I do beg your pardon. I missed them, I admit. Though Lady Keith was so very good and kind, in better hands they could not be. But I do miss them. And when they fully understood my betrayal, they howled most pitifully. Yet my grief was somewhat lessened by their fascination with the apes that gathered round, by their continuing suspicion of my seriousness, and by the cheerful laughter that reached me when I was quite far away, nearly at the bottom of the hill, watching two intertwined serpents rising in the air almost the whole of their length in an amorous clasp. "Oh, sir," cried a messenger from Mr. Hardy, "please could the doctor come and look at Abraham White? He's fallen down in a fit." Abraham White was, in fact, quite ill. Comatose, bloated, heavily contused. Yet this was not really a question of apoplexy, nor yet of epilepsy. For reasons best known to himself, he had brought three concealed bladders of rum aboard to drink slowly, privately, with delectation. But believing himself detected by the ship's corporal, he'd done away with the evidence of his crime by swallowing the whole potful, had choked, and had pitched down the fore hatchway. He lay pallid, insensible, only just breathing with a barely perceptible pulse. Yet Stephen, after some years at sea, was quite used to pallid, insensible seamen, And when he'd made sure that Abram's limbs, spine and skull were unbroken, he pumped him out and had him carried to the sick berth. He was perfectly well and going about his duties by the time Jacob came back. If anyone had noticed his absence, it must have been thought official or medical. A spell at the hospital or the like. For his return excited no comment at all, particularly as he had again changed his clothes. He found Stephen counting glass-hard slabs of portable soup, and he said, "I do hope my sudden disappearance did not prove inconvenient. I had sudden word of a friend the other side of the water." "Not in the least. They hoped the voyage was worth the displacement." "You shall judge for yourself. On the other side, their notions of security are contemptible, and I have my information from no less than 3 concordant sources." They were speaking French, as they generally did when there was anything of a medical, private or confidential nature, but now, even so, he lowered his voice. "The Arzila galley is at present in Tangier, loaded, very heavily manned, and as heavily armed as a galley can be. 2 24-pounders in the bows and 2 in the stern, with a fair amount of musketry when she proceeds under sail. The guns are said to be particularly fine. Brass, very exactly bored, with truly spherical and accurate round shot. Murad Reis, who is in command, means to pass the strait, unless there is a very strong east wind in his teeth, on Friday night. A night of complete darkness, to make straight for Durazzo, deliver his gold. He has given his parents, wives and children as sureties, take his 10th part and return, using his great strength against all the merchantmen he finds." "It's a bold stroke." "Indeed it is. Murad Reis is very well known for his bold strokes. His bold and almost invariably successful bold strokes. He always helps fate as much as ever he can, and this time he has hired 2 smaller galleys to act as decoys. 1 sailing close to the African shore, and 1 in mid-channel, while he, lying under Tarifa, makes his dash along the European side." "Amos," said Stephen, "I am inexpressibly gratified by your news. Will you come and repeat it all to Captain Aubrey?"
"Certainly."
Jack listened to him gravely, his face gradually assuming the look of an eagle, one of the larger eagles, that sees its prey at no great distance. "Dr. Jacob," he said, shaking his hand, "I thank you very heartily indeed for this piece of intelligence, this matchless piece of intelligence, as I believe I may call it. So, if the wind has anything of west in it, Murad Reis sails on Friday, lies under Tarifa until, I presume, the turn of the tide a little after midnight, and so makes his attempt. Clearly we must be ready for him." He reflected. "And there's this to be said," he went on. "If there's so much indiscreet talk in Tangier, and if an account of it can come over so quickly, we must suppose that any indiscretion on our part may go over to the other side of the strait with the same speed. Now, I shall stop all shore leave, of course. And since by tomorrow morning we shall have all our supplies, the only thing that could betray our intention of sailing is the carrying of our sick ashore. I'm ashamed to say I don't immediately call the sickness to mind." "Oh, as to that," said Stephen, "we only have a couple of obstinate poxes and a hernia, and those I can hand over the rail to my old friend Walker of Polyphemus late on Friday evening." "Very good. Very good indeed. So by the time any fool chooses to blab, we shall, with God's grace, be well out at sea."